Hello and welcome to the World Hearts Business for Good podcast. My guest today is a leader from Nestlé, the world's largest food and beverage company. Emma Walker is the head of marketing capability for Nestlé UK and Ireland, responsible for developing Nestlé's marketing talent. A passionate advocate for Nestlé's business as a force for good, she's wrestling with how to better enable marketers to make a difference through their brands. Emma, thank you so much for joining us today. Tell us, what path did you take to get where you are today?
So I guess my path with Nestlé started as an undergraduate. I was studying BBA management at Lancaster University's Management School, and part of my degree was a year in industry. And I saw that Nestlé were offering a placement in a department that doesn't even exist anymore. And I carefully thought, well, how am I going to get this job? So I wrapped up my last Rolo, popped it in a box, and sent it to the recruiting manager with a letter saying, my dedication to you, Nestlé, I present to you my last Rolo. And then I panicked because I suddenly thought that Nestlé might think that my package was a bomb or something. So I actually phoned ahead and ended up talking to a wonderful guy called Malcolm Burridge, who's still at Nestlé today. And thankfully, he didn't think I was some crazy person. And I guess the rest is history. I arrived at St. George's House, our head office for the UK, and they had Quality Street in this enormous bowl. And I thought, crikey, if they're going to give me chocolate and interview, this has to be the place for me. And since then, I've done a mixture of different commercial marketing roles, working for some really cool leaders and brands. And when I was off on maternity leave, I started just to reevaluate my priorities. And I guess the cliche of what kind of world do I want my daughter to live in raised its ugly head. And so I decided that it was really important to me at the time to readdress the balance. And as much as I love Nestlé, and I really do, actually, I'm a passionate advocate of the business, I had found that, you know, for much of my 20s, probably like most people, I'd worked around the clock, pulling very long days. And I just wanted to make sure I was going to be present for Grace. And the other thing that had been beginning to bubble in the back of my mind was, well, what am I going to do to help the broader community? I think as a mum, I started to feel that I needed to give something more back. I felt, you know, I live a very privileged life, and yeah, that sense of needing to do something and take action started to play quite a formidable role for me. So I was very lucky because I have some really great sponsors. And when I was talking through the options with Paul, our HR director, and my line manager, Ben, at the time, who'd been exceptionally supportive, I got a phone call from my mentor who just said, hey, Ems, the marketing capability role is coming up. You should really apply. And so I guess it was meant to be. I now work 3 days doing something I absolutely love for Nestlé, and I get to spend the other four with Gracie and Andy, my husband, and the Community Foundation, who are a local philanthropic organisation. So yeah, I feel very lucky to live this life.
We often find, Emma, that when people are inspired or confronted with life-changing events, and motherhood's a classic example of that, that how they respond to that is often informed by their values. I'm really interested to know, how have your upbringing and your personal values influence how you do your role and influence your wider approach to your life?
Yeah, so I had a really lucky, very privileged childhood. You know, my parents were an extremely strong influence in my life. And I think I always felt we were this little team of three. You know, mum and dad both worked really hard. Mum was always there and continues to be the quiet organiser in the back. She holds everything up, kept it all running like clockwork, and something I think I've really come to admire that actually even more since becoming a mum. She was really present and, you know, would talk to me about my day and collected me from the school bus. And that meant that we could, you know, I could connect regularly, and she gave me, I guess, the security and the feeling of unconditional love, which I think is so important for children to have. And then dad is is just this amazing ideas person. You know, he's absolutely full of them from morning until night, incredibly driven to make things happen. And he instilled in me, I guess, this really strong work ethos, but also the confidence to stand up for things you really care about. You know, he is a big advocate of the underdog. He's still doing that today. And actually, ironically, he's actually building a community hall as we speak, roofing it, I think, was the plan for today. And when I look back at my childhood, I think there are probably three fundamental turning points for me. Mum and dad ran their own company. And when I was about 7 or maybe 8, the accountant committed fraud and stole everything. To wake up the next morning and not have a business, for your future to be at risk, was quite a humbling experience. And, you know, I think we've seen with COVID that, you know, people are genuinely only one step away from a crisis. And I think there's a belief in society that sometimes it's of your own making. Well, you know, my parents worked really hard. They're honest. You know, they hadn't done anything wrong. And actually, it was the institution that had failed them, because they weren't able to bring the accountant to justice. You know, he transferred all the money into his wife's name, and that was the end of it. And watching that as a child, not only did that instill a value of justice in me and the desire to do the right thing, but actually I saw mum and dad build a business back from the ground, you know, working hard, long hours, but just that tenacity to keep going when the going gets tough. And, you know, I've really admired mum and dad for that. You know, mum was steady and dignified. Dad just got down, got creative, and was just hugely resilient. And I think that was quite a big moment for me when as a kid. And then
what age were you, mum? What age were you when that happened?
About 7 or 8. And I remember it so much. I remember arriving at dad's at their office at I'd been for a horse riding lesson. I still remember walking in and, you know, seeing everything unfold in front of you. And, you know, that's quite a strong memory in my mind, actually. And the other thing that happened was I was really badly bullied at school. You know, in middle school, I think partly because, you know, maybe this particular kid, I think she probably craved the relationship that I had with my mum and dad. I think she was quite acutely jealous of that, and I'm not proud of it. But after about 2 years of, you know, genuinely fearing going to school and coming home crying most nights, I had a fight with her because I'd been doing judo and I chipped her knee bone. And I then like ran to the headmistress's office, and being the goody two shoes I am, told her what I'd done. And I mean, she was really nice to me and sort of, I think, basically implied that it was about time that I'd done something about it. But I think what's interesting is that, you know, rubbed off on me. And actually, I think whilst on one hand, it makes me fiercely protective of being kind and helping people, the negative side of it is that I can be of a people pleaser. And so I find it hard to say no. I sometimes worry far too much about what people think, and I've got better at it. But, you know, if I don't feel particularly safe in a relationship, you know, I won't ask that person for help through fear that they might think less of me. And that definitely hindered me when I worked on the dog category. And then I guess the final thing for me was my granddad. You know, he was a really good man, full of fun, full of life, and he had dedicated his life to the NHS. And he really inspired me to get more involved with the charitable sector, you know, just not really charities per se, but I guess caring for your community and lifting people and helping them. And he, when he died, I was, you know, devastated and spent a few summers needing to do something, I guess. And I worked as a carer, washing people, feeding them, you know, going shopping for them, changing bandages, putting cream on their legs. And honestly, it's probably the best job I've ever done. You know, I loved it. It was so rewarding. I used to bounce out of bed at like 4:30 in the morning and be there, like getting people their breakfast and driving all over the county. And I think that made me very determined to get involved with charities, but not just person to person, but actually how do you affect systematic and systemic change? Because ultimately, there are so many people who need help. And yeah, I guess that's what's driven me into the Community Foundation for Surrey, because I can see the long term benefits that they can bring to the local community.
You know, Emma, I always love this part of the podcast, because the things you get to know about people who you think you already know. We always love getting an insight into the person behind the position, and it's remarkable. I think I did find it was interesting when you say that you're concerned about you know, people pleasing, because you did chip her knee, Emma. I'm sure she wasn't too pleased about that.
No, I'm sure she wasn't. Yeah, no, and I
think I have to. Yeah, there is teeth to your compassion, I think.
Yeah, there's definitely a backbone, but I didn't tell my parents actually that I chipped her knee bone for about a year, and it was finally my friend who dobbed me in. We're having dinner one Friday night, and she said, "Oh well, Emma chipped so and so's knee," and I went, "I haven't told them," and I think actually they congratulated me, but I was mortified.
Yeah. My wife can't stand it. Whenever my boys get into a little bit of a ruckus, I always ask them if they won or not.
It's really it's the one thing parents aren't supposed to do, right? But we all secretly want to know.
Yeah. Well, my uncle was a boxing champion and stuff. I came from quite a, I don't know, how would I put it, Irish, Scottish, working class male background. So they would see standing up for yourself as a fundamental attribute. So they'd have been very proud of you as well. There you go. So, I mean, and the story about your parents, oh my God, that really chilled my blood, the idea of somebody. And isn't it disgusting when people can play the game and evade justice like that? Mm. You've touched on things that could be perceived as failures, and how you most definitely grew out of them. Do you want to go into that further? Or let me give you a choice if you can answer one of these questions or both. Is there a failure maybe in your career, or maybe that was an apparent failure at the time that set you up for later success, or you're glad it happened, or if you feel you've covered that, what decision or action are you most proud of in your career?
Yeah. So I, you know, I'm quite open about what I think was one of my biggest failures. I think there's been a couple, but the one that I probably learned the most from was when I arrived in Purina, working on the dog food category, and I was responsible for Bakers. And, you know, I think with hindsight, I was just really arrogant. Some 20-something person, I felt I had something to prove, and my need to be perfect was in absolute overdrive. I felt that I didn't have time. I talked myself into that I needed to make decisions and just get stuff done and prove myself. And actually what resulted is I stopped listening to consumers. I didn't really spend enough time thinking and reflecting on what consumers were telling us. And therefore, I made some stupid mistake. My boss needed us to find some profit. You know, and as often that happens in companies, and that was a really valid ask. But the thing is that the way I went about it was wrong, because what I should have done is added value to the brand, and instead I allowed a price increase to go through at a time when the brand was already losing relevancy. And so my mistake, whilst probably wasn't the root cause of the situation, it gave consumers this perfect opportunity to go and try something new. And so honestly, I spent the next 4 years working frantically and driving a team incredibly hard to fix it, to make the brand whole again. And once you've lost relevancy, getting it back is really, really hard. I mean, it is an absolute slog. And so I guess the learning is, A, always invest to maintain relevancy. But actually, you know, it probably resulted in ultimately the thing I'm most proud of, which is I I learned the hard way. I worked on some amazing projects, you know, from really understanding consumers, because I guarantee I would never make that mistake again. You know, got to craft insights, build brand positioning, launch new brands, new products, do portfolio strategy, create communication. I mean, I was just so lucky actually, it was just this awesome training ground. And I think that it's made me more credible in the current role, because actually I really empathize and I get it when you're up against it and, you know, you're on a brand that's failing. It's really lonely. And so having somebody to talk to within the Marketing Academy, I think goes a long way for people. And I take that very seriously. You know, I'm really proud of the Marketing Academy, and don't get me wrong, we've got a long way to go on it yet, but the fact that Nestlé is investing in talent and taking capability and functional capability really seriously. And when you get that note at the end of the day and someone says, oh, Em, thanks so much for that catch up, or I just got that job, or, you know, oh, we've just launched this new campaign and it's performing really well, and you've played some small part in that, it's the most rewarding thing in the world.
Isn't it amazing? Actually, one of the greatest gifts of setbacks is humility.
Yeah.
When you've been there yourself, you can really feel what another person is going through. And I imagine there's so many people in your team that are deeply grateful that they can come to you, but you wouldn't have experienced it, or you wouldn't be like that unless you'd gone through your own pain, to say the least. Mm. Okay, so you've been you're obviously very self-reflective and quite open, and struggles that you've had. Tell us about what you're most proud of.
Oh, that's really hard.
That's so British. isn't it though? You've rhymed off all the challenges, and now you can't say anything good about yourself.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I don't know.
You don't have to answer if you don't want to.
I guess on a personal level, you know, it wasn't easy stepping away from or deciding to do something quite different with my career. I've done that twice now, once moving from marketing to sales, and then, you know, moving into the capability sphere. And, you know, I'm really proud that I've made those jumps on both times. Actually, I've learned so much doing both roles, and I'm a big advocate of moving between departments and I guess divisions, because I think it makes you a better professional ultimately. I guess that's probably what I'm most proud of.
Yeah, and obviously you'd sown the seeds that you were able and had permission to make those changes. Emma, thanks so much for opening up to us there. I want to come now to maybe more marketing specific questions, because I have learned so much just from some of your off-the-cuff comments during our speeches we've done together to your team or in our conversations. One in particular, when I just met you, you were doing a talk to the Microtyco graduates who were doing in Nestlé, and you said in the past marketing was all about a brand or a product's technical attributes, but now it was about its story and its purpose. And looking into that further, and there's a report from the Global Leadership Forecast said that purpose-driven companies outperform financial markets by 42%. Companies without a sense of purpose within their vision or mission underperform by 40%. So why do you think purpose-led marketing, indeed business a force for good, is on the increase?
Yeah, I mean, for me, this is a fascinating area. And I think it's really important that we ground purpose-driven brands. You know, fundamentally, it's about being relevant to your consumers, you know, understanding their anxieties, their fears, their desires, all of the things that are going on for them in their world. And, you know, I think Aileen Santos from Unilever talks about this really nicely. You know, she said in the 1970s, it was all about product functionality. And then it moved into like more of the emotional benefit territory in like the late 80s, early 90s. And actually, probably one of my favorite campaigns that Nestlé has ever done was the Nescafe couple. You know, that stopped talking just about how great Gold Blend was, and it started talking about the relationships and the emotional connections that it helped people to form just over a cup of coffee. And so that, as sort of brand positioning has continued to shift, and because brands fight to remain relevant and differentiate. And so they have to raise their game. And in doing so, the expectations of consumers change. And I think in our era of marketing, we're very lucky because consumers are now awakening. You know, we're fundamentally human beings, right? And, you know, we as people, and I mean, Mick, you are an absolutely perfect example of this.
The interview's not about me, Emma.
we're moving into a world where we're more aware of the issues that are facing humanity and the planet, partly driven by the rise of the internet, because it's democratized mm-hmm. information and put consumers and, you know, disruptors in control of the story. So you don't need to kind of just accept things at face value anymore. You can go and get any information you want on any topic at any time of the day. And I also think that has, you know, started that knowledge and increased awakening is driving conscious consumerism. And, you know, if you look back at some of the kind of the gurus of marketing, I think I read in the Campaign publication back in January that the foundations upon which we've relied from the climate to politics are burning, and that the fire can no longer be ignored. And I think that's interesting when you start to combine that with disruptors such as Greta. You know, we're humanity is demanding action to face the biggest challenges of our time, because frankly, if we don't, the planet's gonna not do so well. And I think that increased knowledge is impacting how consumers feel about things. You know, let's be honest, we're always going to have consumers who chuck away a bottle of Coke on the floor and leave it for someone else to pick up. I mean, you know, you see it every day, litter on the floor. But I think there is an increasing body of people who don't just walk past that anymore, that they feel a sense of collective responsibility and they want to do their bit to help. And I think therefore they look for brands that share those values. And if a brand can make you then feel good about the choice you're making, i.e. they go further than just giving you a fantastic product and kind of doing good, suddenly that's an opportunity that brands just can't pass up. And you know, I think JWT were talking about 85% of consumers are more likely to adopt sustainable behaviours if they can see the impact of climate change themselves. So we as human beings want to, you know, we don't trust what people say to us anymore. We want them to prove it. And I think that's going to be, you know, really important going forward. And I think that's why purpose has really come to the forefront. We want to know that the products we're buying minimize negative impact and maximize the positive impact, all at the same time as delivering shareholder value, which is challenging.
So we've got so many questions to get really under the skin of this, because this, you know, it's such a fascinating subject, and I think you're in a very particularly enlightened place to comment on it. Let me ask you this. Delivering brand purpose credibly is inherently difficult, right? Otherwise, I mean, we've all seen some brands that have done it less well, shall we say, and the backlash that came from that. If it was easy, everybody would be doing it brilliantly. There'd be no such thing as woke washing. What, from your position, what advice do you have for marketers who are trying to navigate and genuinely want to turn purpose to action? What are your top tips, Emma?
Yeah, I mean, crikey, this is such a difficult area, isn't it? And we run a module in the academy with a wonderful agency, actually, a partner called 1HQ. And I never forget Amelia, who is fantastic. She gives the team a set of cards and she said, right, you know, read these cards, and on them is each card kind of outlines an example of a brand demonstrating its purpose, and you have to decide basically whether they're woke washing or you know, greenwashing, or whether they are genuine. And mm-hmm. it's really interesting, like Amelia and I kind of stand there and watch this debate unfold, and people get quite animated. And what's interesting is I started to notice that people had different ways of categorizing whether they felt it was a good example and therefore they put it in the halo category, or whether it was like a bad example and the brand was just really cleaning up its act and claiming, overclaiming, if you like, and that was it dealing with a shadow, and they had to put it in each bucket. And what was interesting is that we got different answers, same cases, different answers every time. And usually the team base their answers on how the group felt previously about the brand. So if they already had a negative outlook on the brand, they almost used it and they could justify the case to put it in the shadow box. If they kind of instinctively liked the brand, they would find all these reasons why it was a halo. And then there came this thing around, actually, the team also, it came down to how much knowledge they had on the initiative. You know, if someone in the group understood something and was really educated on the particular topic, they would either support or disprove and give reasons why that particular brand or company, you know, why it should go in either box, because they would understand a little bit more of the holistic picture that that brand was operating in. And then the final thing that I noticed on every discussion was how big the company was. You know, if the company was big behind the brand, they got a tougher time. Just fact. The expectations were higher. It was almost like the smaller brands just seemed to get a little bit more of benefit of the doubt. Or, you know, and I'm not sure that that's whether that's a UK thing or what. I still can't quite make my mind up on it. But fundamentally, I definitely noticed, and maybe because we're a bit more sensitive, you know, being from a big company, but there was definitely you definitely had to hold yourselves to a slightly higher standard, I guess would be a fair reflection on it. And you know what it demonstrated to me was and something that the Honest Product Guide by Futura makes, is that you have to do three things. I think firstly you have to understand consumers. You know, what do they expect, what do they care about? You know, what you can't just go around and start talking about or taking, you know, positive action on something that your consumer group just fundamentally don't buy into, because obviously you're not going to be relevant. But let's assume you've got that for a second. Then fundamentally, you've got to be open and discuss your corporate practice. So, you know, how is the bigger company, particularly if you're large, progressing against its commitments, and what the proof points that you can bring to the party. I then think you have to deliver, before you start talking, tangible proof. You know, what's the impact you're going to demonstrate through the initiative you're taking? And if that initiative is seen to be opportunistic, or it's a one-off, or it's disingenuous to your, I guess, what your brand stands for, you've got a real problem. And then finally, I think you have to align your brand with the consumer values. And often that means being a bit more humble and, you know, and explaining that you haven't got the answers to everything, but that you're working on it. And you know, I think consumers are pretty accepting that, you know, companies have to make money, right, for the world to go round. Even charities have to make money. And you know, fundamentally that means we have to sell more product if you're Nestlé. But I think the intent has to be more than that. I think you as a company have to want to create a better future. And I think if you genuinely, and your employees, because ultimately they are the company, want to create a better future, I think that is the starting point for, you know, for everything, really.
Isn't it interesting? I often find, because I come from the startup world, that startups do get it easier. Mm. You know, people give them the benefit of the doubt. Mm. When you're a brand the size of Nestlé, and then with the history of, you know, almost 150 years, I've noticed that from startups, friends of mine have scaled, they're faced with the exact same things, you know, like having a large corporate entity with a great distribution network taking a share in their business, and then they're accused of selling out, but they couldn't scale without it. So I think startups do get a pass, but everybody eventually faces the same challenges of scale or trying to do things on a, as I say, on a larger scale. Yeah. On that point, I'm really interested. Nestle sells over 2,000 brands across 187 countries. Is it possible to have a unifying purpose when you have so many diverse brands? Is there a, does a brand of Nestle's scale have to have a unifying theme that touches all its brands? Or does each brand, can it have its own identity and the whole company doesn't have to have a unifying theme?
Yeah, so I mean, I fundamentally believe that the range brands have to have their own point of view and their own voice and their own small contribution. But yeah, I mean, I fundamentally believe there has to be a unifying theme. And I think actually that's why Nestle is, has maybe where we've not done as good a job as our competitors like Unilever and Danone. And, you know, it's definitely possible. If, you know, let's take Unilever as an example. You know, they identified very early on their sustainable living brands. So they acknowledge that they've got lots of brands in their portfolio, some of which are, if you like, very, very, very aligned to where they're heading as an organization, as a bigger company. And those sustainable living brands, they have poured, you know, investment and driven change and positive impact. And that affords them some time, I guess, to frankly sort out and address any issues in the rest of the portfolio, however addressing those issues, whatever that might look like. You know, when you look at their performance, those brands are growing, I think they quoted recently, 69% faster than the rest of their portfolio. And now they account for 75% of their total turnover. I mean, that is just phenomenal because they've remained relevant. But yet we haven't managed to capitalize that and tell our story well enough. And I think that comes down to three reasons, really, and three things we've got to do as a company to enable our teams to win. Firstly, is that Unilever did a far better job at integrating their strategic thinking up, down and across the organization. And I think Mark Schneider really understands this. And I think he's already made some serious inroads. You know, even recently, we've relaunched our story and the business is getting far clearer about the job to be done. And I think we were always clear on the job to be done, but it was in these little silos and these pockets of expertise. Mm-hmm. And it's about getting that that strategy hardwired into everybody, right, in every function. And then I think we have to work more collaboratively. You know, I was talking to Andy Griffiths, who, you know, is a formidable player in our organization and actually makes a, you know, amazing difference to sort of the community that Nestle works with. And he was saying to me that, you know, our job is to really take our great science and take our knowledge and our expertise and then collaborate with those to start solving the problems together. And I'm not saying Nestle hasn't collaborated previously, but I think we've got to just open the door up a bit more and not try and solve the problems ourselves all the time. And I think we're getting better at that. And then the final thing that for me is a big enabler is about mutual accountability between local markets and the centre. Mm-hmm. You know, often the NGOs and customers are moving far faster than the government in a lot of cases. And so I mm-hmm. think we've got to be prepared to work up solutions and push them up the chain, as well as being willing to listen when the centre want us to see the bigger picture and not just play for one brand, but play for the group. And so I think managing that positive tension becomes quite important, you know, and all that's got to happen faster. You know, Nestle can just be too slow sometimes. And so we've got to eliminate the barriers. We've got to enable people to win. And actually I've seen that happening more and more. You know, COVID was quite a good example. Nestle did something quite special. We have always put safety first, but my goodness, did it come to the forefront. I have never felt safer as an individual working for a company. We were at home before anyone else. We were well taken care of on the whole. Yes, I'm sure there's pockets where we could have done things better, but I think, you know, what the supply chain achieved, the positive difference we made, you know, to help society, you know, putting £1 million behind school meals and donations that we made to Fair Share and just the leadership role we showed. I'm not sure we've necessarily done a great job of broadcasting that. Maybe we shouldn't right now. But I think when we're clear on the mission, actually Nestle can move mountains. That for me is what gets me up, because that's the Nestle I love. And when we do stuff, we do it really well.
Emma, you know, it's fascinating. I am listening to some of your leaders, when they shared me the Nestle vision of unlocking the power of food to enhance the quality of life for everyone today and for generations to come. And you see so many examples of different leaders in Nestle doing that in different territories. But to your point, one thing I've noticed as an outsider is consistently Nestle is very reticent about talking about all the good things that it does, which is very interesting from a cultural point of view. And that leads me, because I really want to stay on this subject, because there's so many areas to explore in it, about this idea of authenticity that you touched upon. One of the biggest challenges of big brands who want to market brands with purpose is authenticity and how they're perceived. There is an immediate, as you say, the bigger the brand, you tend to get a more skeptical or indeed cynical response. There's also the idea of humility. There's like, when I see some brands, if it's going to stick in my throat, it's usually when they look like they're lecturing people or they don't look like they're doing it with humility. And to your point about government, even Larry Fink, the head of BlackRock, the investment company, wrote to all their investors saying that they were going to have to do something about social issues, environmental, social injustice, social inequality, because we couldn't rely on governments anymore. And you touched on that point about the greater demands of consumer awareness that are asking companies to take more action because they maybe don't have faith that governments will be able to do so or will do enough. So my question then is, given that you have to succeed commercially and given that purpose-driven brands are so essential going forward, what are the essential skills required to win on a global scale? And I know these aren't easy questions.
So I think it starts with a mindset. And actually, weirdly, I think this comes back to some good old-fashioned marketing, you know, being curious and wanting to understand the perspectives not only of our consumers but our customers and really importantly stakeholders. You know, like Larry, he is a pretty formidable stakeholder, and so when he writes a letter, you better sit up and listen. And I think that curiosity and empathy of wanting to diagnose what people are really saying to us as a company and thinking about what that means and what are the opportunities that we can create is essential. But I also think we have to give a decent dose of being brave. You know, I think you have to be prepared to put your head above the parapet. When you look at companies like Patagonia, their founder's why is inherently linked with the brand's why. And so actually that starts to make decision-making easier because the company basically embodies the founder and vice versa. And so actually the success criteria is almost hardwired in from the very outset. And when you're inheriting a brand and it wasn't yours from the very beginning, I think marketers all want to make a difference, right? They all want to put their mark on a brand. But actually, I think your job is to really understand that brand's why and then also find out how its why connects with yours. Because if you can find some common ground and you can find you know, what it is that makes you tick and find a small piece of that in the brand, I think actually you can really go on and achieve great things. So I think we have to get intimate with our brands. I think we have to basically be brave and protected at all costs, and that might mean being slightly unpopular sometimes with our leaders who, you know, are KPI'd on results, and we have to walk that constant line between short-term business performance and long-term brand relevancy. Well, you know what, I think that what marketeers have got to do is get more creative at demonstrating how purpose and authentic action on our brands can actually drive performance. And that might mean building a better case. I think we have to link it far more to marketing effectiveness than we do. But I think it is possible. And to do that, you've got to invest in your knowledge. You know, I fundamentally believe that actually, if you want to deliver performance on your brand and you want to be more relevant and you want to make a positive impact on consumers and society and basically do the right thing, and honestly, 99% of people I come across at Nestlé desperately want to do this, you've got to educate yourself and understand the end-to-end value chain and the whole food system. And, you know, the sustainable development goals are a great place to start, but you've got to understand your product, your packaging, the transportation, every single component of how your product is made, consumed and disposed of. And I think that that's of vital importance in this day and age, and actually I think really exciting. It starts to solidify the what a marketer's role is in the future. And then obviously you've got the kind of technical skills, and I think Russell Parsons from Marketing Week, the editor, he is really opinionated on this, and actually I agree with him. You know, he says that the explosion in data and technology has offered marketers many more ways to reach and engage and serve customers. And the fundamentals of marketing, i.e. orientation, positioning and differentiation, have to underpin the decisions we're making. And they are the tools of execution require a different skill set in the future. And they're talking about digital. You know, digital offers us lots of opportunities tactically. But fundamentally, if your brand strategy and the orientation and the positioning of your brand is not clear from the outset, honestly, you've got to go back and redo it, because it all goes horribly wrong later if you haven't got those strategic fundamentals in play.
One quick thing on Patagonia, that you've cited Patagonia a lot and they're fascinating. And to, you know, your point about the founder's why, it's my understanding that when he discovered that the pitons that he was selling for climbers were actually damaging the mountain faces, he stopped selling them, and it was 80% of his turnover at the time. Now, if, and I think when you hear stories like that, you go, that is somebody who genuinely cared about the environment and would have skin in the game that he would take that much of a hit. It is fascinating. Emma, you touched on some really important points. I want to jump ahead to one of my other questions for you, because this is something that really, really struck me when I was listening to the experts that you'd aggregated for your Force for Good program in the Nestlé Marketing Academy. I was struck by the sheer range of topics and expertise within the business they represented. So from just some basic notes of listening to them, they covered the UN's global goals, climate impact, obesity, specifically child obesity, animal welfare, government policy, recycling, and the list goes on. And that was all part of your marketers training program. And it struck me as, do marketers now have to understand and synthesize far more information, both from within the business and externally, than they ever had to before? Does that make it more exciting? Or do you think, for some marketers, do you think it makes it infinitely more complicated and challenging? Because it's my understanding in the past, they really wouldn't have had to have considered so many factors.
Honestly, I think this is the best time to be a marketeer. I mean, you know, there's so much societal stuff happening, and you know, fundamentally marketing is about leading, you know, organizational change, really, isn't it? About listening to consumers and orienting yourself and your brands around it and delivering against those expectations. And that's no different today versus what it was 50 years ago. Fundamentally, what is different, the topics have changed. And so your point around the complexity of some of these issues, that is definitely new. And I think the fact that, you know, in order to resonate with consumers is one thing, but actually we've now got NGOs and other interested parties who we've also got a duty of care to take notice of and to deliver against bigger societal needs. And I think that is new and potentially tougher. I also think what's interesting is, and there's lots of debates going on about this at the moment in the kind of marketing academic world, and you know, Ritson talks a lot, and I really admire him, about, you know, we just need to get our heads back into strategy. And I think he's right. You know, fundamentally, listen to consumers, decide on your brand proposition, and then determine your tactics. And I think for me, the only things that have changed are that we've got way more tactics to deploy now, because the marketing mix thanks to digital, has opened up. And yes, that's complex. And yes, it takes more people resource, as Unilever outlined. But actually, there are so many ways, and it relies on you being really creative and getting your message across in a good way. But the other thing is that I guess is maybe slightly new is we just need to listen to more people now. It's not just consumers. There are customers and disruptors and NGOs that have got a bigger voice now, because and we need to pay attention to that. So honestly, I think it's a really great time to be a marketeer. Is it more complex? I wasn't doing marketing 50 years ago, but I think we have to not forget the fundamentals and rely on our skills as marketing professionals, but just make the tactics relevant in a new world.
Interesting. I'm just thinking of, could you imagine you having a conversation with one of the characters from Mad Men?
Oh, I'd love to. That would be so cool.
When you think of how much marketing has changed.
Oh my goodness, they would terrify me though slightly, I've got to be honest.
So on the theme then of, you know, again, for new, when your Marketing Academy program is really quite remarkable. Again, your teams were learning about, okay, there's a specific factory and what we want to do about reducing the cardboard waste. And then the next conversation was, how do we make sure that we're addressing child obesity? I mean, talk about wide ranging, right? So on that theme, in a previous podcast with Robin Sundrum, Nestle's head of sustainable purchasing, he discussed the challenges that he faced, and he's very committed to addressing them in delivering responsible, ethical purchasing, how challenging it was, even when he was personally committed and the business was committed to doing the right thing.
Yes.
And how so often you can get the law of unforeseen consequences, even though you're, you know, and how deep you have to go into some of these problems to get to the root of it. So from a marketer's point of view, given that you're trying to compel somebody at the end of the day to buy your product and buy it for the right reasons, how do you decide what issues to prioritize? How do you communicate such vast and complex issues without trivializing them?
So I'm not sure if I yet know the answer to this because I think this is the $1 million question, right? But I guess from my perspective, you know, Nestle at a corporate level, because of our complexity and our sheer scale, you know, we've got to understand and act on most things, right? Planetary, individual nutrition, communities that we operate in. And I think that, you know, there isn't a straightforward answer because some of the solutions don't exist yet, and we've got to work with partners to invent them. But I guess a brand's role is to think about controlling the controllables. And I think you have to, it comes back to the point we made earlier around the skill set and the knowledge that you have to build in understanding your value chain end to end, understanding those critical issues that your brand is struggling with in that particular category, and build a strategy to address. So that strategy might be that actually you need some support from the corporate level because, you know, packaging, you know, plastic is still one of the most efficient forms of packaging from a carbon perspective. It's just that, you know, obviously when it gets into the sea, or if it's not recycled properly, or it can't be recycled, then that's a problem. And so that's a far bigger challenge than any individual brand manager can deal with. And so I think you have to rely on the fact that Nestle, we have to keep feeding that and keeping that challenge in the organization. But that's where Nestle's Packaging Institute is vitally important in looking at dealing with those very complex issues. But I think that there are so many more things that brands can do. So, and I think for me, it's about focusing in on those and not for a minute sweeping under the carpet the notion of packaging. I think we have to be open and honest and say what we are doing in that area and deliver on it. But I think what we do have to do is identify the actions we want to take at an individual brand level, you know, where it's really, I guess, relevant to that particular brand and the halo, the over and above positive benefit we want to have, and innovate against it and seek out partnerships and, you know, and then communicate those stories in a good way, but only when you've demonstrated action. You know, fundamentally, consumers can't take on board all the multi messages we want to tell them. I mean, you know, you can't possibly have a podcast, for example, with your consumers and have a nice chat with them. I think if you could, consumers would be like, wow, okay, you guys are dealing with quite a lot. So actually what we've got to do is break it down into one message, creatively delivered, the right time, at the right place. And that's why for me, marketers have got to understand the whole and then identify the one or two things that we've got to talk about whilst we also continue to work very hard to address the issues that we're facing. There are some rules that apply. We've got to show humility. You know, we've got to deliver tangible change. You can't just start telling nice stories. There's got to be impact behind it. You know, that is so important.
That's excellent advice. I think, you know, zoom in on the focus on what you can do. And the challenge is communicating that in a simple, efficient way, isn't it?
Yeah.
On that theme then, within the context of your role and the future of brands with purpose, what keeps you up at night, Emma?
I think the bit that I worry about is, and obviously I can only talk from kind of Nestlé's perspective, but for me, it's that we see sustainability, health and wellness, purpose separate to strategy. I worry about that. People say to me, oh, well, I need a new purpose. And I keep thinking, oh, I just not sure you do. I think you need to just articulate it more clearly. And, you know, fundamentally, your strategy and all that and sustainability and NHW, they have to be part of the same thing. They have to be genuine and you've got to be able to deliver against them. I think the other thing that worries me is that we do nothing, right? I love Nestlé, but oh my goodness, we can talk ourselves out of anything through fear sometimes. You know, we are doing some really interesting, thought-leading, quite game-changing initiatives, and we're beginning to partner with experts, and yet we're just not talking about them. And I think that's because we're a bit nervous too, in case we get shot down. But I guess from my perspective is actually we therefore need to do more of it, and we need to talk more about it in a good way, in a real way. You know, I was having a lovely conversation with the team earlier, and we were talking about the new initiative of partnership that were with Plastic Energy, and they're a major chemical recycling company. And the goal is to try and develop some specialist recycling technology to deal with hard to recycle plastics, such as confect wrappers or dry pet food pouches, the breakfast cereal bags, things that you can't recycle at the moment, and they turn them into oils, and then those oils can be replacement for fossil oils, or they can make food grade plastics. And I was like, wow, this is really cool. And rightly the team checked me and said, yes, Emma, it is really cool, but it's just part of step one on the journey. You know, we've got to deliver it. And so the way we position that story to consumers and be honest that it's just the first step in the journey and it's one part of a bigger jigsaw puzzle, I think that humility is quite important. And I guess then the final thing is that when I think about what stops us from acting, it's about this, the fear and the baggage we carry from Nestlé's past.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I think that past is what's made us. You know, I think fundamentally Nestlé has learned a lot from what happened in our history. And so I think we have to be brave and start to talk more. Because I think the biggest fear at the moment is that people will write our story for us. Now, that doesn't mean that I think we have to do woke washing, be disingenuous, quite the opposite. But I think if we're really serious and we genuinely want to keep making a difference, then actually we've got to demonstrate and drive trust through our, you know, in our organization. And I think increasingly our leadership team are up for that challenge. So I think it is now actually that our marketeers need to really go for it and be bold, because actually Nestlé, when we can make a bigger difference because of our scale, particularly if we're working with some of the partners that we have the privilege of working with, you know?
I couldn't agree more. I think when you see the existential issues that Nestlé has a huge impact upon, to your point you've made very eloquently throughout, it puts the marketer not in the position of how do I convince people to buy this product with a nice story, to how can I actually make significant impact in a meaningful way through my day-to-day role. And I'm really, really grateful that you've opened up to us to such a degree, Emma, because I was so much looking forward to doing this podcast with you. And I know my team are really looking forward to hearing it. We've come to the last question, and there's been so much throughout your podcast that people will be able to learn from. But if you could sit down with, I've got this image of this really arrogant 20-year-old in a judo outfit. As I say, the thing really I love about these podcasts is I think I know people, and then I get to get all these insights into you which we wouldn't normally get. If you could, one, either speak to one of your peers, another large global corporate, or to somebody getting started who really wants to build a meaningful career in brand marketing and create brands with purpose, what advice would you give them? What do you wish you'd known?
So I'm playing around with something at the moment, and actually I'd really welcome any listener who's got an opinion on this. They are really welcome to feedback. But I'm playing around with a 6-point plan to purpose, because I am so fed up of feeling like this is too complex to crack. And so my first point is you've got to get back to marketing fundamentals. You know, we are the eyes and ears of our consumers. We are responsible for getting that into our organizations. And so we've got to listen and then orient our brands around those desires. And that means brilliant brand positioning that's got genuine purpose hardwired into it. And honestly, I think we shouldn't go anywhere near actions or tactics until that's clear and absolutely aligned everywhere throughout the organization. And we've got to be prepared to invest and act on it. And I think Dove is probably the best example. You know, they're one of the longest standing examples where their campaign for real beauty, I think it's like 20 years old now, and it's still as true today as it was. It's just the how it is delivered evolves. And I think that is a testament to that team, that they were forward thinking enough. And it just goes to show, when you get the insight right, actually brand positioning tends to write itself almost. And I think Mark Ritson is genius on this. You know, he says you should spend 33% of your time focused on orientation, listening, empathizing, pay attention to your consumers. Then 33% of your time on strategy, segmentation, your targeting and your positioning. And only then do you spend your time on tactics. And how many marketeers spend 90% of their time on tactics and 10% on strategy? And I think we've got to flick that paradigm if we really want to deliver purpose. My second point of my 6-point plan is doing your homework. You know, fundamentally, the root of all evil on this, and actually the root of inaction, in my opinion, is us not understanding the holistic picture. Too many marketeers just want to jump straight to comms. You know, if I had a pound for every time a marketeer rants at me for saying, oh, regulations have blocked my claim. And the first thing I'll say to that person is, well, that's great, but how much notice did you give them? Did you involve them early on in that conversation? You know, and fundamentally, as marketeers, we have to hold ourselves accountable to understanding the conversation that is happening around our value chain. And that should be our first gate. We should be able to, hand on heart, say and assess, have we got any deal breakers in our brand's value chain that need to be addressed before we go anywhere near talking about positive contributions we can make? And if we have got a deal breaker, you know what, that's okay. That's when you reach out to your experts and you build a strategy with them to fix it. We are very lucky, particularly in Nestle. I mean, we have the most amazing informed experts from corporate affairs, regulatory, NHW, you know, our sustainability team. We are just surrounded by experts, and we need to leverage them. And then I think you have to, once you've, I guess, if you like, got permission to pass through that and you think, you know what, I have got some issues, but I've got a plan in place to address them, then I think there's three questions to ask yourself. What's the halo you want to create? So, and that's got to be linked to your why, and what's your positive difference, impact you're going to make? What are the shadows that you're going to have to clean up? It's okay to be working on shadows, but we need to be open with consumers and answer their questions when they come to us. And then I think you've got to understand what your stakeholders are saying, because quite often what they're demanding is greater than consumers, because obviously are not as well versed on some of the issues don't understand the complexity of those issues. And so I think you've really got to be able to answer those three questions before you move on to the third point, which is talk the walk. Andy Griffiths reminded me of something that Jose Lopez, who was a wonderfully inspiring leader who sadly passed away recently, he used to talk about the fact that, you know, you absolutely have to demonstrate positive action first, and then you create the nice story. And those actions have got to be sustained. You know, there's no one-off. You've got to earn it. I think this is where looking for partnerships and really being thoughtful about what the best way of addressing those challenges is really important. I love the example of Tesco and WWF working together, for example. I think this is where Nestlé can really open its doors and do something quite powerful. And only when you've demonstrated and you've done some of those actions can you then tell your story. And you have to do it humbly. You know, it's got to be creative, because you've still got to cut through all the noise. It's got to leverage the different touch points, you know, across your entire marketing mix. And I think we have to keep in check our own expectations at this point, because marketers want to be praised, right? I think we're not always going to get praise for this stuff, and I think that we have to accept that and also recognize that being in a large corporation, there will be stones thrown at us, sometimes for the right reasons, sometimes maybe not quite so fairly. But as long as we have got prepared well, understood our position, have a good response, I think we've just got to start going for it. Maybe when those stones are thrown and there's some truth in them, and we've got to sit up, pay attention and act fast. And I thought Tesco's response to Greenpeace a couple of weeks ago was a good example of that, actually, where they didn't come out and say, oh, Greenpeace are bullying us. They said, you know, we're listening and we will work harder to work with Greenpeace. And that is absolutely the right response, in my opinion. And I think the next point on the plan is being clear on the impact you're going to drive. You know, fundamentally, this comes down to the discrepancy that consumers don't want you just to be transparent. They want you to prove what impact you've had. And so we have got to really think through those measures and make them as important on our brand dashboards as profit and market share, in my opinion, and hold ourselves accountable to those. And, you know, seek our leaders out to also have that in their objectives, because actually that will help us all to drive to something better. And that might mean we've got to find more, you know, often it comes at a cost of having, you know, driving impact, doing positive things might cost us more money. That means we've just got to create better sales stories as marketeers. We've got to prove why that is going to result in brand equity, and why brand equity is going to result in increased performance and long-term profitability. So we're going to have to get better at doing a sales job, I think. And then finally, and something that I think is true today as it was 50 years ago, we have to drive cultural change. Marketeers are the forefront of change. And so I guess the thing I'd probably leave you with is that we are the only ones that are really, truly connected to consumers and customers and stakeholders. And so we have to get that knowledge with our sales colleagues and with our corporate teams back into the C-suite. And we've got to do that ahead of competition, because if we can do it ahead of competition, that's where the competitive advantage is. And so banging the drum, sitting up, being curious and elevating the voice of the consumer means that point one of the plan keeps happening. And I think that is ultimately the job of a marketeer in this new reality.
Emma, this podcast has almost been like a mini masterclass in contemporary marketing. You've covered so much. And I'm really so excited for your teams get to hear this podcast, as well as the wider World House audience, because the whole purpose of the podcast series is to share best practice from people who are at the sharp edge of delivering business for good in the real world. And you have covered so much stuff that I'm going to be reflecting on at length. You've given me a real insight into things I should be doing about Wild Hearts as well, which I'm feeling quite guilty about our marketing from what I've learned from you. So there's so much wisdom in there, and I'm so, so grateful to you. So thank you so much. I'm so looking forward to seeing this work come to life in your marketing academy and the wider work that Wild Hearts is doing with Nestle, which is very, very exciting. And thank you so much for giving us so much of your time today.
Oh, thank you, because you've made me, I've had to think very hard, and actually that's a good thing, because it, you know, hopefully that will mean that we create better, you know, training material for our team. So likewise, I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.